majority was a legal reason to send that. And I will do some separate issues in a separate submission a little bit later this morning. Our joint submission is also supported by a number of different organizations. And that's just a list of the organizations who've chosen to support this joint submission. In our sector, we try to be as efficient as possible with our time and resources. So I won't read them. You can all see them there. All right, so getting to the substance of it straight away, from these organizations who support this submission and ourselves, we would like to communicate general support for this amendment bill to the committee. We are generally pleased with the changes proposed. We are generally pleased with increased penalties and attempts to fix various weaknesses in the current legislation. It's a good sign, we think, that the department is trying to tighten up various provisions, and it's also evidence of attempts to enforce legislation. We also really appreciate the department consulting us on a previous occasion before coming to Parliament. Not all departments do that. All right, so we're going to talk just about two key issues in the bill. One is the issue about Section 24F and G and emergencies, and one it really deals more extensively with Section 24G, the rectification provision. We have highlighted a couple of other priorities for law reform. It's not in the bill. but we just like to make sure that stays on the agenda. But we won't spend much time on it today. All right, so Section 24FG and emergencies. The current provision already provides for an exclusion to criminal prosecution under 24F. From our point of view, we are concerned that the provision might be open to abuse, and we would prefer to see some introduction of some element of proportionality to make sure that we don't have condone massive overreaction or condone very extensive activities that should have received authorization beforehand in response to a very small emergency. We'd also like to see some protection from dirty hands where somebody creates their own emergency. We see that as a possibility. And we would also prefer to see that penalty being increased in line with other provisions. I think it's now being proposed to go up to $5 million. And the other provisions tend to talk about $5 million first offence and $10 million second offence. We think it's a good thing that our legislation has a uniform approach to penalties across the board. We've actually proposed some specific wording regarding the proportionality element in our written submission. Then just the issue of...
Which page of your written submission is this, the amendment to with the proportionality?
It's on page 3, paragraph 17.
3. Which one is that? 3 there.
So you've added that proviso. It is a defense to show that the activity was commenced or continued in response to an emergency so as to protect human life, property, or the environment, provided that A, the activity commenced or continued is proportional to the risk to human life, property, or the environment that the activity sought to limit or avoid, and B, that the emergency was not caused by the
person. I don't have it here on page 3, that's why I'm asking. Where? Page 3 is the annex. Thank you. submission may be, the pages may be differently numbered. What are you, where are you looking? Sorry, there are two submissions. It's this one, page 3. So you say it's the 17th line, the proviso. Oh, there, that proviso. So this is a defense if they were to be charged. And you saying that the court shouldn't just have an open defense, but you would like to see the proviso added to as a temperance of their of the
That's
case.
Right.
Okay.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, now I understand what you say. We'll examine that. Okay, sorry for disrupting. I just had the wrong submission. I had the other one you've done. Okay, go ahead.
All right. With regard to the delinking issues, also that was discussed during the briefing, we see the delink of the administrative fine for 24G applications in cases of emergency. That we're happy with that. We have no problem with that. It's fair. We don't want people to pay fines if it's not necessary. Also the delinking of the trigger for 24G, the criminal offence, and having to acknowledge that you've committed a criminal offence before you can apply. Is also improvement, which brings me to the next issue around 24G generally. Chair, and honourable members, we've made quite a detailed submission about this issue of section 24G, and the department will be aware that for a long time we've agitated about this particular section. We've called it a monster. We believe that it's become a monster in our legislation. We note the department's attempts in this amendment bill to fix some of the problems around 24G and its application, but our view and the view of many, many other civil society organizations working in this field, and in fact, some consultants as well, believe that this provision has gotten out of control. It's become entrenched. It's created perverse incentives within the department, and it's really become a way for violators of our legislation to buy themselves out of the consequences of their actions. Initially, 24G was really intended as a transitional provision, and it's now become, because of the administrative fine that it generates, just for processing that application, it's become a reason for departments to accept applications for rectification, even when that really shouldn't be the case. And in our experience, once you've accepted an application for rectification, there are no other enforcement consequences. Generally, we see in the provinces that the departments are accepting these applications, and that will be the end of all prosecutions in those situations. But they also don't see themselves as having a discretion to refuse accepting those applications. So it really has just become a tool in the hands of developers particularly, but all people who undertake listed activities to avoid the lengthy EIA process and to avoid criminal prosecution once they've commenced without authorization.
I understand the criminal prosecution side of it, but I mean, surely you can't have nothing. You're suggesting to scrap it, but then you've got nothing there. How do you then deal with the transgression other than prosecution? Let's say that people have done something major to change them. I don't know what, I'm just using an example, but build a dam. They built a dam. They haven't got permission. It's in a wetland, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, so what do you do then? What are you suggesting we do I understand the prosecution side. Clearly that must happen, but in terms of how you then deal with that wrong situation,
sure.
What do you do?
I mean, there are quite a lot of different options. We've done quite a bit of research, we've done a little bit of international research to see what people do in other countries. There are some other options available. Just currently, we do obviously have directives and compliance matters in our legislation that could be used to give instructions either on specifically on rehabilitation. It's much more difficult, though, if it's a big development like a dam, which you know, it's really quite difficult to dismantle and rehabilitate. I mean, it will have to be a tool that gives quite a bit of discretion depending on the situation for the department to decide what the best way forward is now that we're already saddled with this huge
development. Do you think what we do is to structure whatever other remedies there are, first to build directives or whatever, whatever other remedies, and to have this as the last one?
Yes, absolutely.
At the very end.
Then
one will have to structure it differently because what you're saying is that because of the way it's worded here, they don't look at the other remedies. They only look at this and they think they have to only do this.
That's right. Well, they think they're entitled to do it. It's not even that they have to. They are entitled and the partners apparently don't believe that they have a discretion to refuse those applications at all. The other option that we see internationally is that it's linked to the whole criminal prosecution of violators in these situations. So you would say you can apply, but only once the whole prosecution has taken up course and there's a conviction at the end of the day. Then once it's all been sorted out or there's a conviction or there's some sort of decision in a criminal case, then only then can you apply. Those are some of the other options available. It's not ideal, though.
No, I don't have a problem with saying that they must first be prosecuted. I have a problem to say to wait for the prosecution. I don't know.
It takes a long time.
I don't know if you know how criminal courts, you'll be old before you get there.
But that is a disincentive in itself, of course.
Yeah, but the problem is you'll have a illegal act that exists then for 3 or 4 years, which is not... But I understand what you're saying. I'm not too afraid with it, but I really understand what you're saying is that clearly there needs to be a more structured approach to it and that it shouldn't just be this response. There should be others. And you've mentioned at least two, the one of the criminal prosecution and directives. What other mechanisms in the Act, you must understand, I don't understand this Act very well because I haven't been around for much long, but what other mechanisms are in the Act other than directives and criminal prosecution that could be made part of this process? What others are there? Can you tell me offhand or will you just have a look at it and tell me later?
There aren't really any other ways of doing it. I mean, there's of course no principle bar to allowing people to do an environmental authorization after the fact. There's no problem with that, per se, in our legislation as it stands. Right now, because of 24G, that has to be used. But there's no reason for that. And in fact, that's what the other departments do with water use licenses, with under the MPRDA, they allow applications after the fact. So that's also something for us to look at. However, in that situation, I would again argue for inclusion of more fit and proper person tests, so that if somebody has done something like this once and completely ignored the law, and while knowing that that was an offence, which is often not the case, that they are not allowed to apply or not allowed to hold the authorisation, or there could even be potentially a period where they're barred from applying. To make sure that they don't continue this and to become serial offenders across the country.
Okay, that's a good suggestion. Second offender applies.
Chair, we've also, sometime last year, I think we, was it the year before already, I can't quite remember, we made quite a detailed submission to the department on another version of 24G to provide for different levels of fault, because that was one of the big problems. It doesn't recognize when somebody is willful or somebody is just negligent in doing and undertaking activities illegally. So those are just quite sophisticated things to deal with, I think, across the country for enforcement officers. But I think it's possible. I guess, Chair, what we're calling for is an overhaul of this provision, a rethink of how we deal with the after-the-fact rectification of illegal activities.
Give me some... hopefully you'll send that other submission of yours to us, the one you made to the Parliament, the one with the different levels.
I think it was an annexure to our submission.
Of this submission?
Yeah, the very one.
Annexure A or B marked up with explanatory notes. Annexure C, comments and inputs. Well, you'll show me later.
Yes. And the other thing we obviously just want to draw to the Chair and the Honourable Member's attention is this thesis done by a master's student just recently in Gauteng that basically affirms our arguments around the abuse of Section 24G. I think it's just important to take note of that research as well. I've got a copy here as well.
Is this monster's thing?
That's too big.
September, is it? Right, you should have in your package, it's, 073. It's in your package, Leah, September, okay?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Right, that's really all we want to say about this provision. As I say, we know that the department is trying to fix things. What concerns us about this bill is that it actually attempts to not just fix the problems, the smaller problems, but also to expand this, include undertaking waste management activities without authorization. And we just worried already there are a lot of vested interests around Section 24G, where some departments are funding posts out of the fines they're getting for 24G, and those are vested interests that are difficult to undo. So we're just a bit concerned about expanding at this stage. When in fact what we think is crucial is a complete overhaul of the section. But we'll leave it at that.
Yeah, because this applies to at least those two ministers plus 9 MECs.
Yeah.
So it applies to really 11 entities. Okay.
All right.
Have you ever drafted something that staggers it like you suggested?
Staggers it in terms of time?
I mean, the way that you're suggesting that, you know, at least, even the way you said it, you know, the prosecutions must first take place. Have you ever redrafted this section in any way?
We haven't redrafted that. The only drafting we did was around the different levels of fault.
Well, if you do that, you can send it to us.
All right.
I'll have a look at it. I don't like the idea to prosecute completely first, but the whole idea of definitely prosecuting as part of the process is... if you draft it in a way that we can have a look at what you're saying, and then it's easier for us to ask the department what their comments are. Because we now have your views on it, but not actually to see what it will look like. Yeah.
All right. Just a couple of other comments, Chair. We won't go into details. This is really the stuff that's not in the bill rather than what's in the bill, so we'll keep it very short. The one is the issue of administrative penalties. We appreciate the increased criminal penalties in this amendment bill, we still argue, as we've done on a number of occasions in the past, that relying on criminal penalties alone is too difficult. It's too difficult to get those convictions and those penalties, and it's not enough to be a disincentive. It's the experience across the world, it's not just in South Africa. We have a beautiful example of administrative penalty system that works exceptionally well under the Competition Act, and really acts as a disincentive for violators of anti-competitive behavior. You would have thought that is not quite as dangerous to our society as environmental violations. So, again...
Why does the department not want this? What have they said to you?
I don't think they've ever responded to that. I think it requires quite a significant institutional and legal overhaul, and that's the reason, not an unwillingness. We've made similar submissions to the amendment of the National Water Act, so you never know, that might come into the revised National Water Act. And then finally, just the issue of integrated permitting. We see references to that in this bill, and obviously we support that wholeheartedly. We'd like to see a streamlined permitting process. We are in the process of preparing some elements of what do you think an integrated permitting system should look like, and how that would assist for better environmental governance across the board. Okay, what,
this committee supports that integrated permitting, so we'd be interested to see what you produce.
Alright, so just in conclusion, we support the bill. We've made our submissions about Section 24G. We prefer it for it not to be expanded, but rather to be overhauled completely. We'd like to see a meaningful administrative penalty to improve compliance with, our environmental legislation, and then streamlined integrated servicing.
EMMA should not expand the scope of 24G. That is the waste of it. That you're saying it shouldn't apply?
We prefer for it just not to be expanded any further at this stage.
And what applies to waste? Nothing.
If
you don't apply time or properly in, on waste issues,
I mean, I think
there's no law applicable at the moment.
The reason why waste has been included is because of the streamlined application process that is applicable, and in fact, you now do have to do a full EIA under NEMA. It's the same process, right, as I understand. It's the same process for to get a waste management license, and that, it makes sense from that point of view. We're just cautioning against expanding this the next time round. It includes three commission licenses and other permits, when in fact we're asking for that section to be redone. Or scrapped.
Yeah, I personally am not in favour of scrapping, but I'm definitely, from what you've said, but I'll hear what the department says later. It does seem to me that there needs to be some redoing. And you've made quite a few suggestions and you'll follow it up with some information. Okay, members, very clear four suggestions. Two of them are not in the Act at this stage, but seem to be worthwhile issues to pursue, depending on what the department responds to us. But the other two are there also? Well, all four of them are obviously open for question, but the two specifically have been suggested is to add a proviso to the defense that has been created, which, forgetting the exact wording, seems to be a good suggestion, and the other one is to add a whole lot of amendments to the 24G process, and then further not to extend it. Any questions on those issues? Was it clear? We have asked also that given to give us further information. Anyone? Ms. Wenger? Dr. Huang? Ms. Bengu? What, give me an example of the kind of things that are happening under 24G. I mean, in practice, from the smallest kind of things that are happening, which are clearly not that worrying, until the really big things that are people are just going ahead and then later on get exonerated under the section. Well, what kind of things have you seen in practice?
Chair, we see a huge range of different levels of these things. Obviously from the census point of view, we do a lot of work around mining, so we see a lot of this happening in the mining sector, where we see, you can go and build a big open cost mine, like has happened in Eastern Mpumalanga in one of our cases, without any authorization, without royalties licenses. It's usually accompanied by all sorts of other authorizations that you don't have. And then now coming afterwards, trying to get a royalties license, trying to get an approved EMPR from the Department of Mineral Resources, and doing a 24G application. We also see, it's a weird thing, this rectification provision, because we see motivations being issued for environmental authorizations on the basis that the damage has not already been done. So,
we've done it. But we can't fix it up, so now just give us permission.
We even see that some of the departments using that as a motivation for saying we now want to authorize it, or what else is going to happen to this arrangement. So it's very unfortunate. I think even in the department's own explanatory memo, they referred to this idea of budgeting for a fine. Part of the problem also lies in the procedures, and we see that people, that there's no sort of single procedure for 24G. There's no clarity on how it links with the EIA regulation. So we see kind of directives being issued by the department, but they're not the same across the country. They're not always available to interested and affected parties. But either way, it's usually a shorter process than a proper EIA. And that is, of course, another substantive problem.
So it may be worth our while also, if we do amend this and go ahead with it, to actually create a provision that, I don't know, is there a regulation provision in this Act?
Okay.
And do we have any regulations under Section 24G to tell the different entities how to exercise this power? So there's no regulations. So it's in the Act, but there's no way that we're telling the different provinces and the departments how to exercise this power to get uniformity. And what is our attitude to this whole idea to create a more nuanced clause that lets you jump through different hoops at different times before one exercises this power? Bearing in mind that if one were to act tough on one case and people lose money through that process, they may very quickly stop not acting without authorization. You know, if they do start a mine and you just don't give permission for them to go ahead with huge losses of finances for them, it may be, at the moment it just seems to be a clause that I think is necessary, and personally, because you need to rectify something that is not legal, but it just seems to me it's just an open-ended clause. It's just, as has been suggested, I can understand, obviously, everyone is applying it differently, and in some instances probably not even putting up any fight whatsoever. What is the response from your side?
Okay, Chairperson, what we try to do with the current provision is just to do some quick fixes. But we are at a moment debating Section 24G and how it should be amended in the various working groups. So we actually plan to come up with further amendments, if necessary, during the next amendment bill. But at the moment, we only did some quick fixes. But there are two things that I need to point the committee's attention to. Firstly, at the moment, it doesn't apply to mining. Although Section 24G refers to mining, it's not, before mining, it's not in operation yet. It do apply to ancillary things like, for example, roads and petrol tanks, whatever is listed under our list, but it doesn't apply at the moment to mining, and those provisions are not in operation. And
so does this make it now applicable to mining? If you pass this amendment?
The amendment is there, but we may not bring it into effect for mining per se immediately, because there are negotiations between the two departments at the moment. There's another process. So at the moment, all the...
But what I'm asking, I understand that, but I'm asking, yeah, you've now amended just the name of the... That's not going to change anything, even if you're amending the name. You're saying until there's a further decision taken to make it applicable to mining, it doesn't apply to mining.
That's correct.
And what decision has to be taken other than those other amendments last time? But why isn't this clause applicable to mining? It's in the Act, so...
Okay.
Have we specifically, when we put this clause into operation, did we specifically exclude mining?
That's correct.
How?
We have done it...
What is the instrument? Which way did we... I'm just trying to understand in my head how we did it.
Okay. Chairperson, what happened is that it's a whole history to this.
Yes, no, I know that.
But this specific clause was there previously. We just changed the... But
yes, now that's what I'm just trying to understand. I'm asking a technical question, not to a political question. I'm saying, in here, the Minister of Mining is mentioned.
That's correct.
Plus MECs.
That's correct.
Now, what did we do to not make it applicable to the Minister of Mining? I'm just trying to understand technically what we've done, because you say it doesn't apply.
Okay. In the 2008, okay, there's a bit of history. In the 2008 Amendment Act, it specifically says that the provisions as far as it relates to mining will not come into effect, or it will come into effect only when the last act, there were two amendments act. There was the Mineral Petroleum Resources Amendment Act, and then there was the act, National Environmental Management Act. And it says it will come into operation on the date that the last amendment act will come into operation. The 2008 Mineral Petroleum Resources Amendment Act never came in operation. So there are negotiations.
I understand what you're saying, but I mean, that is not a, you know, an act comes into operation through a promulgation.
Yes, on a date determined. So what we will
now, now, if you say in another act
yes,
that the provisions of mining are not going to apply until that act comes into operation, that act isn't in operation, so therefore those clauses that you've written don't apply.
That's correct.
Therefore, if you've got an act here which mentions the Minister of Mining,
what we will do in the proclamation when we bring the act into effect, we will say that the provisions come in operation except insofar as the provisions...
No, that's the old act.
No,
you see, the act you've drafted that hasn't come into operation says this,
yes,
if I understand you correctly.
Yes.
I'm saying until that act is put into operation, the clauses in those acts doesn't apply. So if that act says it doesn't apply to mining, it doesn't apply because it hasn't been put into operation.
Yes.
This clause here in this act was probably put into operation through a proclamation by the President. That's how you put an act into operation.
Yes, yes.
Now I'm asking, if that is the case, forget that other act because it's not applying. How does the Minister of Mining in this act not actually have this clause apply to it?
Okay.
Because if the proclamation put this section into operation, it can only not apply to minerals if the proclamation says, but section 23G or 24G will not apply to mining.
That's correct.
Did we do that in the proclamation?
We did it. In terms of the other act, if it says personally...
But Ms. Scarlett?
But in terms of this act, we will do it in the proclamation indicating that it...
Okay, you're not understanding me. Bring me the proclamation that put this act into operation. You see, another act that hasn't been put into operation has got no legal effect whatsoever. It cannot be the reason why this act doesn't apply to mineral affairs. Because there's no legal effect. It's not been put into operation. So even if you've got a clause there that says it does not apply to mining, until we have put that act into effect, until you do it. So this clause has been put into effect. It is legally applicable at the moment. That's why we're amending it.
But if I bring you the Amendment Act, you will understand why the provisions are not in effect.
No, but Ms. Garlop, that can't be the answer. Because an Amendment Act that has not been put into operation has no legal effect. So there's nothing to understand. All I understand is that it doesn't apply. Sometime in the future, if it does come into operation, then those clauses will apply. What you might need to just show me, and look, let me leave it for now.
No.
What you must go and show me is why this section...
not in effect.
Don't bring me the other act because that's not applicable. You must show me the proclamation that put this act into effect, how it says that minerals doesn't apply to minerals. Okay? That's what I need to know. But your answer originally is that you guys are looking at a detailed amendment, possible amendment to this, and this is just a stopgap amendment. Okay.
Chairperson, I just want to respond to the waste management, the expansion to the waste management activity.
Let's leave that for later,
okay.
because while I'm taking submissions, I don't usually, all I'm trying to get is clarity at the moment. That's why I'm asking you. I don't want you to respond to people's inputs. That would be unfair, okay? You have a chance. At the end, I'll give you a chance to put down whatever you would want to respond. Sorry, I've deviated a bit, but I'm just, for my own sake, trying to understand what is why and so on. Still no questions? Okay. Obviously, I can now see if it applies to, well, it doesn't apply to mining. I don't know if it applies to mining. The examples you've used of mining, clearly, according to what the department is saying, don't even fall under this clause.
Sorry, I need to just clarify that. We're not referring to mining activities because it's not listed right now and it doesn't apply. You're absolutely right. We're talking about those ancillary activities that Mr. Carlos was talking about. So, for example, clearing the land before you start the mining activity, accessing, building access roads, airstrips, above ground fuel storage, underground fuel storage, all of those other activities related to it, which of course can be significant. You would, in any event, to get a water use license, for example, to do deviation of water courses or water use licenses, you also have to do an EIA for that purpose. So it doesn't really matter. 24G is still relevant for all of those activities. So the fact that mining is not...
So the ancillary issues does apply to, but it doesn't apply to the mining itself.
And those are extensive and significant activities with impact on the environment, so it doesn't really matter for our purpose. But yeah, we can provide other examples of the committee. We're happy to organize that. There are many, many, many across the country.
Look, it'll be useful. I'm not sure how we want to deal with this issue because if there is a process to amend this thing properly, clearly you're going to participate in that. But that makes this amendment quite difficult for us, how to assess it, because you know, one doesn't know how long this process is going to take, and we know how long bills are going to take, and if there's a flaw in this process, then we've already got some problems. So maybe what we must look at is what other stopgap things are needed until then.
I mean, something like increasing the penalty, for example, here is an excellent idea. I mean, just recently, Chair, you know, I think last year already, when we had the biggest fine ever for 24G was about 9.2 million rand in the Call of Africa Makangukwe matter. And that was at a stage when we were using 1 million rand per activity. That was the maximum fine. It's not the existing situation. 1 million rand per offense, right, for the 24G fine. And that will now go up to 5 million, I think, is the proposal. It's important to understand, it sounds like a small thing, but that particular development of Call of Africa was 600 million rand at one point, capital expenditure. So 9 million rand sounds like a lot of money, but again, 600 million it really isn't a lot for commencing and constructing 90% of a big open cast coal mine without authorization.
Just help me, but who gave the fine?
The fine was issued by the department.
Yes. So what do you have? You had an administrative process you go through, and they have to come and answer you, and you give them a chance to, and then you fine them. How does it work?
Listen, I will ask Francis to respond.
Yes?
Chairperson, sorry. The way in which the 24G process works at the moment is they would put in their application to us. We would then send a requirement letter based on what they're actually applying for. In the case of Call of Africa, we did make them put in separate applications for each activity that they'd commenced with unlawfully. So it came in, I think, as 10 or 12 different applications. They would then put those applications and we would then write them a requirement letter telling them what studies, assessments, specialist reports, public participation, whatever other requirements we need. Once they finished that process and gave us all those reports, we would then assess all the information in there. We then have a specific calculator that we use based on environmental impact to assess the fine. We then take it to what we call our enforcement panel, where all the units that have input into the fine process would sit, and that panel would then recommend a fine to the decision maker. The fine would then be issued to the offender. And they would then have a certain, I think it's about 30 days within which to pay the fine. They also have an appeal process. So if they're not happy with a fine, they can appeal to the minister. And then after that appeal is processed, the fine's issued, they pay the fine, and then a decision would be made as to whether to grant them authorization or not.
So they must first pay the fine?
Yes.
And why don't we prosecute people?
We do prosecute people. I think from the National Department, I think there's been quite a few cases where we've run 24-due processes and prosecuted people at the same time. I think the difficulty that we're having at the moment is the National Prosecuting Authority, particularly within certain jurisdictions, are finding it difficult to agree to prosecute where a 24-G process has been followed. Some of them don't seem to have a problem, and others seem to have a problem. What we've heard from some of the prosecutors is they believe that once a 24-G decision's been made, that person has been fined, and they're almost seeing it as double jeopardy. We do have an opinion that says it isn't double jeopardy, but there are, and we're having those difficulties.
No, it's two different things. I mean, one is a civil process whereby you're paying for what you've done wrong, and the other one is you've transgressed the law.
We agree.
And it's a criminal offence.
We are busy kind of not fighting, but disagreeing and challenging and trying to convince them that...
What about this idea that we actually let the National Department either pass regulations or something other that has legal binding effect to actually bind people to the processes? And if prosecution at this stage is one of the issues that we say should be definitely dealt with in each instance, that can be part of those regulations as you, or directive or whatever we do. Won't that help to try and harmonize how we act in this case?
I think we could probably do regulations that would give more, at least more detail as to how the process should be followed, because, you know, in some cases the process is followed in a different way. In most of the cases that we deal with at the National Department, we do issue directives or compliance notices as a first step, and we actually stop, and in many provinces it does happen like that, but unfortunately it's not consistent, where the illegal activity is stopped, so they can't actually carry on building or doing whatever they're doing until the 24-G process kind of is finalized, which often does ensure that at least they do all and give us all the information quite quickly in terms of that. But
it's all part of regulations. It's part of the legislation. There's more effect. There's more, definitely more knowledge about it.
I think.
But let's look at that, okay? Let's look at that. I think I've heard what you've said. All right. Are there any other questions? I seem to, for now, have run out of them. Nothing? Okay, thank you very much. Much appreciated. And if you can let us have that further information, that would be good. Just this other process you're busy with, is there a deadline to this process? Because it's obviously going to impact on how we process this legislation. Have you got a deadline to this other process you're busy with?
We plan to introduce a new bill June next year, almost, yeah.
When?
June next year. So
June next year?
Yeah. We
Because what are you guys, on strike or a go slow, or what's the problem?
Jefferson, there's a whole procedure that we need to take a bill through.
Yeah, but now you see you create difficulties for this committee. Because if you're now telling us that these processes may only start a legislative process which is going to start next year, June, it must then go through the Cabinet Committee, it must then go through Cabinet, it must then come to Parliament. So you're actually saying that the next administration is going to deal with this matter?
No, Chairperson, what we intend to do is to table the bill in Parliament next year, June. That means we have to go through the processes this year.
All right, well, we'll bear this in mind, but it does create difficulties. Okay. Thank you very much. What is it? What? Bruce is not here yet. That's really disrespectful. Tell Dr. Lotta she is very disrespectful to Parliament. All right, Then I see Leo Resources is here. That's luckily for us, there is someone here to make an input. That's fine then. If you haven't, got a... Oh wait, okay, no, that's fine if you sit there. Welcome, and you know the drill, it's quite informal today, so please go ahead.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to present submissions. I'm presenting on Clause 38 of the NEMA Laws Amendment Bill, which deals with Section 85 of the Biodiversity Act, so I'm only addressing that one point. But it's a significant point because it deals with benefit sharing and indigenous resources in what was in areas which have got traditional leadership, and so it could have significant consequences for the for people who live in those areas. I will just if I can just give a little bit of context, and then I'll.
This the establishment of bioprospecting fund. That one.
Yes.
Okay.
Correct.
All right. Section 38 in the bill, and it's section. Sorry, Clause 38 and Section 85 of the Act.
That's correct. So I'm only dealing, in fact, with Clause 85.5, the last clause, or should I say Section 85.5, which says that notwithstanding Subsection 2, when a stakeholder has established the traditional council in terms of the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act, all money arising from a benefit-sharing agreement and material transfer agreements must be paid into the bank account of the relevant traditional authority. So that's the only provision I'm dealing with. So just by way of background, the purpose of the NEMA Biodiversity Act is to promote the sustainable use of indigenous biological resources and also to support fair and equitable sharing of benefits. So what it does is it regulates the prospecting, it regulates the export, and it regulates the benefit sharing agreements by stakeholders. And in order to do this, it defines indigenous resources, it defines stakeholders to agreements, it requires permits, and finally it sets up this, what is the bioprospecting fund, into which the prospects of the proceeds of these agreements must be paid. And then they're paid out to the what they call stakeholders. Okay, so the current situation is you enter into one of these agreements, the proceeds goes into the fund, and then it's paid out to the stakeholders. What this new provision proposes is that the money goes into the traditional council, and then it doesn't say where it goes. So that is concern number one. And if one looks at the bigger context, this particular amendment relates to the areas which were referred to by the apartheid regime as the homeland. So we're talking about some of the most marginalized and economically deprived areas of the country. And their access to indigenous resources and their development of those resources could be significant. But they're basically faced with a statute which says you enter into an agreement, maybe with a foreign investor, and then the money goes to the traditional authority, and thereafter you don't know. So there's a complete inequality between people who fall outside of these areas who then get the money back, and there's no real intervention by the state. It goes to a trust fund, and then it goes back to them, as opposed to people who live under the...
Just explain how it works at the moment.
So currently...
So if, wherever, other than in our homeland, what happens today?
You're living in the macro land,
yeah.
And you develop the hoodia.
Yeah.
Then it would go into a bioprospecting trust fund.
So do they always create a trust fund for the area where this agreement is from?
I think it's a national trust fund.
Okay.
So in other words, it's got one standard for everybody. So the money goes in the trust fund and then goes back out to the stakeholders. And the stakeholder is defined, the Act currently defines a stakeholder as a person who has traditional uses or knowledge and discoveries. So essentially indigenous knowledge. Now, if you're living in what was previously defined as a homeland, the proceeds must go to the traditional authority. I'm not quite sure whether that...
As it is now, when you give them the money, do they use it again for biodiversity upkeep or maintenance, or does the trust that it goes to, can they use it for anything?
I think that as it currently stands, the money just goes to trust and it goes back to the stakeholders. It seems to be just a way of, a form of oversight, because the whole statute is aimed at preventing the abuse of these resources, which are often in the hands of very... vulnerable and disadvantaged communities. So you've got all these oversight mechanisms, and I think this is the point of having the trust fund. But But now, if you live in one of these traditional leadership areas, it's not clear where the money goes. There's nothing but, from what I can read, it just says it gets paid into bank accounts. Then you go and you look under the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act, and you see that there's not very much regulatory control around finances. And also in different provinces, it's applied differently. It's formulated differently. So the sort of regulatory controls over this could vary from province to province. So not only do you essentially lose as one of these stakeholders, you actually lose the asset to the traditional authority, and then it could be different in different provinces depending on how the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act is applied. And those are all in our submissions, those points. But
because in sub 4, it says the Director General is the accounting officer of the fund. So at least the DG must go and account for it.
That's correct.
So if you take it completely out of the loop, then that clause 4 is not going to apply it's notwithstanding sub 2, it's notwithstanding even sub 4 as well.
Yes, because...
But you're not going to the fund, you're missing it, so how can the DG account for it?
That's correct. And then the other thing is, which we find is problematic, is it comes to definition. Because if you look at section 85.5, it says where a stakeholder has an established traditional council. Now, a stakeholder can be a person living in Cape Town, who perhaps their ancestors farmed buchu in the Makwaland or something like that, or in the Transkei. So it says where a stakeholder has an established traditional council. It's difficult to understand what that actually means, because a stakeholder can be a person. So how can a person have an established traditional council? So I think the whole formulation is difficult to apply and difficult to create certainty about who falls under it and who doesn't. And then there are issues about the actual geographic spatial arrangements. I mean, often these biodiversity issues extend over huge areas. So you could have people falling under different traditional authorities. Or you could have people falling under a traditional authority and others falling outside the area. And then you also currently have conflicts about the boundaries of traditional authorities. And you have some conflicts over the legitimacy of the leadership. So this is just fraught with potential uncertainty. And the bottom line is that if you are an indigenous, if you have indigenous knowledge and you want to develop it, you've perhaps got a foreign investor's interest. And what you're faced with is potentially huge conflict. There could be people who, you don't know where the money's going to go to. If there are people who are also part of your group that live outside the area, where do the proceeds go for them? There could be a conflict over the borders of the area. You know, the potential conflict is endless. So I just don't think that this particular provision, the consequences of it have been properly fleshed out. And I think it should be removed. If there is a reason for this, it needs to be part of a broader process of law reform around traditional authorities. And to have it suddenly emerge in a NEMA laws amendment bill, I think that makes it difficult to contextualize it within other processes which are attempting to address development in these traditional areas and to develop new laws around them. So I would submit that this if this is desirable, it should form part of a bigger process of regularization of the previous homelands and shouldn't be treated separately and put into an environmental law. I've sketched some of the concerns about how this might be in violation of constitutional laws, for example, the principle of authority, of equality and the right of freedom of association. So it's potentially up for constitutional challenge. And then it's also potentially in violation of international laws, which the Act binds South Africa to as a signatory. And one of them is the Convention on Biological Diversity, which tries to promote the independence of traditional communities in exercising, in developing their indigenous knowledge. So to my mind, it's in complete conflict with that, in that the whole proceeds of whatever they're developing, they lose, and it goes to the traditional authority. There are some practical problems as well, Honourable Chair, about the whole world of traditional authorities. In some areas, they haven't elected these authorities. So in a situation like that, it's not clear who should receive the proceeds of such an agreement. As I've said before, there are also boundary disputes. And also there are...
Just tell me again the definition of stakeholder.
Yes, a stakeholder...
Where is that found in the original Act?
Yes, and it's under... it's in the definition section, it refers to a person, an organ of state or a community contemplated in section 82.1A. So if you go to 82.1A, it refers to a person including an organ of state or community providing or giving access to the indigenous biological resources. So it could be a person who has a traditional knowledge about something. It doesn't have to be the traditional authority itself. So you could have an agreement between a whole lot of people and a German investor, and the traditional authority is not part of that agreement. Yes, the traditional authority gets the proceeds. And then
the definitions in any case seem very loose.
And then
that second part, just read 82.1 again.
82.1A, shall I read A and B? 82.1A is a person, including an organ of state or community. So it could be a juristic person or a natural person.
Is there anywhere that it says how you define a community in 82? I mean, I know organ of state is defined in the Constitution, so at least there is some guidance. But is there anywhere what is meant by a community? Ms. Advocate Garlick? I'm just trying to get to understand the argument. It does seem to me this is very loose, these terms, and I'm trying to work out what is the stakeholder.
No, it doesn't define.
If it says a community, who will decide who is a community? Who decides that? For the purpose of this section.
So there's no definition of an indigenous community.
Yeah.
And a person, it could be an individual living in Cape Town whose parents, you know, from Kuku or something like that. But I think it's essentially what I think is highly problematic about it is it discourages development. Because who would want to invest in something like this where there could be so much conflict over who it applies to, who the stakeholders are, and the regime for them receiving the proceeds? So essentially, people who live inside these traditional areas would be discouraged from trying to develop their indigenous resources. And our argument is these areas are the most economically marginalized and disadvantaged in the country. And there's another point which was raised around the Communal Land Rights Act discussions, and that is that there's a lack of investment in these areas because of issues of property. You know, one can't necessarily get a mortgage bond over communal land. So one finds that there's less money invested in these areas because of uncertainties about property rights. And I submit that this suffers from the same problem, in the sense that the property rights are not clear. Who gets the benefit?
Well, it's probably, you know, I don't understand these things well, but it also seems to me, just if you look at purely from a legal point of view, I would imagine if you go to the traditional act and so on, there they tell you what is a traditional council and so on, and I would imagine that automatically falls under a definition of stakeholder, because it's a community. Therefore, you would not necessarily need a clause like this. All this clause then does is to take it out of the purview of accountability of the DG, which is difficult to understand why we want to do that. If we do it for all other stakeholders in the country, why would you not want to, at the very least, let the money come to a central point and then be handed out like everyone else, and then whatever ways that the DG has of regulating accounting, those apply. So, any particular reason we wanted to do it like this? Were we approached by the traditional leaders to do it like this, or what is the, where does this come from? Just to try and get some clarity, because there's a lot of uncertainties in what Ms. Andrews has raised, so I'm trying to understand where this comes from.
I think the intention of paying directly to the stakeholder was for one reason. Currently, the agreement, the benefit sharing agreement, is an agreement between the bioprospector as well as the stakeholder involved. So in such a situation where there's already an established sort of relationship and the increment in terms of the payment of the account, the amount due to that particular community or stakeholder, the intention from the department was that because the intention of the trust fund established in terms of 85 was for the purposes where this community or the indigenous community is basically, we can't identify a sort of an entry point. So it was a DG then, the money was held on behalf of that particular community. Or where you have a situation where an illiterate community is involved, then that amount is actually held on behalf of that particular community. Then after the benefit then accrues to that particular community, then the amount is paid to that particular community. But where a situation where you have an already a well-competent indigenous community or organized community, there's no need for that money to come to the state and then go back out.
But the question I've asked is this. If the traditional council, by all intents and purposes, seems to fall under the definition of stakeholder,
I think the...
But if it does, then the money is going to go there in any case, and that is the way. So it's difficult to now understand why you would not want it to go... I mean, it can't be illiteracy.
No,
it can't be... Those aren't the reasons we can... I mean, because they are clearly identifiable as a stakeholder. So there is an entity, I'm calling it an entity, there is an entity to which the money must go. Otherwise you're going to lie in the fund forever if you can't identify who the entity is. Then there's a problem with that definition. So that can't be the reason why illiteracy can't be the reason why we want to...
No, I mean, there might be other reasons from colleagues, but what I'm trying to say here is the reason behind the amendment was from our side was that it was not feasible for the DG to have some money that may directly be paid to that particular stakeholder. Because the issue of trust, because that trust fund was supposed to be established in terms of the particular legislation. So there was supposed to be trustees and all that. So there was this issue of the reason for the amendment was where possible, for example, where the community may be identified. So that money should go directly to that particular community. But where that amount, that money, the community cannot be identified, then that money should actually come to the DG and then the DG then dispense that money. So that
okay, we'll discuss this further because your definitions in the bill don't lend it to that interpretation. The other problem I have is that this bill may now be completely procedurally incorrect because any issue that deals with traditional leaders must go to the House of Traditional Leaders for comment first before it comes to Parliament. So if you've now got matters of traditional leaders in here, we may have followed the wrong procedure in Parliament. And procedurally this legislation will be. So I want you to check this, Ms. Gallup. As I understand it, issues of traditional leadership, the Council of Traditional Leaders get a chance to comment on the legislation before it comes to Parliament, and then those comments are also sent to Parliament. It's a separate legislative process that's created. Now, that also worries me now that it looks like we may have not followed that procedure, and we may have those problems as well. So it can add it to Ms. Andrews' legal and constitutional problems. Maybe the wrong procedures also been followed. It means the act will have to be withdrawn, etc., etc. But you look into that for us, okay? Okay. Sorry, I interrupted you to just try and get a bit of clarity, but go ahead.
Honourable Chair, just in response to that, the problem is that it creates an unequal regime for people who fall within traditional authorities and those who fall outside. It creates, in our view, an inferior form of governance for people who fall under traditional authorities because of the uncertainties that it creates and the fact that one doesn't know where the funds go to. So there's an inferior form of governance, less clarity. And also it applies even when the traditional authority is not part of the agreement. It would apply to anybody who in other words, the traditional authority can lay claim to the proceeds of this agreement if someone enters into the agreement that the traditional authority says falls under their jurisdiction. So I can be sitting in Cape Town entering into an agreement, but because I grew up, or my family grew up in the Transkei, suddenly a traditional authority in the Transkei says, just hang on, the money comes to me. So this lack of certainty and this different regime for people who live under traditional authorities, in our view, creates an unequal situation and an inferior legislative dispensation. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
You see, your argument, the problem with your argument is the reason you've got the definition of stakeholder is to create certainty. Because, I mean, if you're saying what is correct, will you be suggesting to me that every single present stakeholder that falls under the fund is one that we can't define clearly? Because that's, I mean, the reason we're putting in the fund is because we can't define it clearly, so we put it in there so we can then define it and give the money. Now, if that's the problem, then your problem is the one of the definition you have. And then to go and create a process where you're now allowing one grouping to act completely different, this seems very wrong, because it's your definition that's wrong. It's not your... Ms. Advocate Carla?
Chairperson, I'm going to ask Mr. Karika just to explain what was the intention behind the provision. And we've looked at the comments of the Legal Resource Center, and we will definitely take it up with the Minister. But maybe just for the clarity of the committee, what is our intention with the current provision?
Thank you, Chair. And I will just try and clarify a little bit, but also we'll give it to my colleague to just fill in the areas that I may have missed. But the way the trust currently operates is that the department receives an X amount of money, and we disperse, the DG disperses X amount of money to the beneficiary. So the administrative costs around this fund are taken over by the fiscus, because most of the money is not a lot. So if an individual or a community is due to receive 5,000 rand, the way it has been set up is that they must receive 5,000 rand. And we also realize that in the provisions of the Act, it talks about a trust fund. I mean, a trust has to be established with trustees and all those things, that those structures that can only take even more money from the system. So what we did in discussions with our finance people and National Treasury was to create almost what a suspense account, where the money comes in as an ATM and goes out, X and out. So that's the first spirit behind this. Now, as we implement the law, we also discovered that actually there are certain recipients or beneficiaries that have mechanisms in place. And most of them are not even regulated by a council or tribal authority or anything like that, because beneficiaries can range from an individual, a community, or like the colleague is saying there, a juristic person. So they can be a beneficiary. So the intention behind this is to make sure that to change the law in a way that where there is already an existing bona fide structure or account that can be verified by the expert group that advises the minister in issuing the payments, that this particular entity or this person or this organization is entering into an agreement with this community or this individual or this organization, and there is this bona fide account that has been verified and all that, then the money must be paid directly to that account, so that in the end, all the minister will need is annual reports because the DG will still be accountable to make sure that the right things are done, nobody runs away and they don't...
Where does that stand?
So...
Where is that duty created? If the money goes straight to the people,
yes,
to this bank account,
then,
where is this duty that the DG must still account for the money created?
In the regulations. The an account will be nominated that has been subject to scrutiny to verify is legitimate. But it's not necessarily through a council. That was never intention. I sit here from the line function and with my colleague. It's not through necessarily a council. If a council exists, yes, there's some council, for example, they have a council and they nominate through their lawyers. We pay through that. But there's sometimes a beneficiary to come in.
But this, you see what I don't understand.
Yeah.
This is the least administrative duty for you. Because you say there's a council, council existing. So what you are is just an ATM. You don't have to go and look for beneficiaries and so on, but at least we can then see that the accounting officer applies. But if you now grown, for the people that it's the easiest to process and to deal with, where you can just give the money to them, you're now removing them from the parameters of the act and you're putting them under a different system. It doesn't make sense. These are going to cost you the least in administrative fees, if they truly are what you say they are. They are a traditional council with a bank account. Then you have to do nothing. You just have to pass the money on. But you're then accountable later, your DG is accountable. So these are the people that are the least problem, the least money, the least drain on you. You now create potential problems by creating a different system for them. And the other issue that worries me tremendously is fraud and corruption. I mean, you know, to what extent are we going to check that the money goes to this right bank account? That some individual doesn't fleece off the money. So you've opened up the door. At least the other way around, you receive the money, you pay it out directly. You don't have to do anything with that. You just pay it into... It's easier and then you account for it. Now you create space for possible corruption and possible taking of that money into other bank accounts, into other funds. Because if you leave the fund out of the loop completely now, you're not part of the signing of that agreement. So what they say, where the money will go and so on, at least previously that was the fund that went through there, so you'd know that there was some government check and balance. You're now taking it out of the check and balance completely. Yes?
Thank you, Chair. There are two things that a number of things we need to be clear here. Is that firstly, the mechanism of the DG still disbursing funds directly does not completely fall away, because there will be instances like my colleague Subsiso was saying that maybe somebody is illiterate or something. They don't have a mechanism. The DG will still administer.
Yes, yes. No, I'm not talking about that. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying
and
that. Traditional council, this clause that you want to remove, that's what I'm talking about.
Then the minister approves the beneficiary agreement with conditions. So in that, there will be mechanisms that will compel the nominated account, the recipient account, to report backwards. Then the accountability of the DG still stands in that, because these are submissions we got from public here. Consultations, and they say there are existing mechanisms that the DG can nominate, but then subject to annual reports or bimonthly reports. But if you may allow me, Chair, let me ask my colleague also to just clarify certain areas that I may have missed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I think he has covered most of the thing. Maybe just to give more information on where do we get the definition of community. So we have found our definition from the NIMA. We have a definition of community. We state that it means any group of persons or a part of such a group who share common interests and who regard themselves as a community. And when you come to chapter 6...
I ask who decides that. That's what I'm asking. I mean, I read the wording is a group or blah, 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 blah. But who decides that it's a community? have the community themselves decided and you just accept it all. But sorry, you go ahead with what you were saying. Let me not interrupt you. Go ahead, there's someone with a question. But go ahead with what you were saying. That's fine.
Okay, and then we come to our chapter 6 where it provides a definition of a stakeholder where it says that it's any person or community and stuff like that who are giving access to the indigenous biological resources. And we also have a stakeholder who may be giving access to the traditional knowledge associated with indigenous biological resources. And when it comes to community, you may find that a tribal authority is owning the land where a particular bioprospector wants to access the resource for bioprospecting. And that is where the tribal authority play a role in terms of negotiating benefit-sharing agreement. But that doesn't leave out other communities who are not part of the tribal authority not to negotiate benefit-sharing agreement in terms of this legislation.
Okay. Ms. Wenger?
Thank you, Chair. I'm more confused than ever before. As long as we're going to have parallel laws and amendments that are running next to each other, we're going to continue being confused. And I think I can see now why prosecuting authorities are not wanting to touch things, because they don't actually know which one they must tackle it with. Whether it's tribal, whether it's the conventional. And we're running parallel structures, and there's always all these exclusions. At the previous presentation, we have the mines excluded. Now we have tribal authorities that are. And if we're going to look at these amendments and we want it to work correctly, I think it needs to be one set of amendments that apply to everybody. Because all these exclusions are going to only create confusion, and we're going to get absolutely nowhere.
Okay, well, those are the issues we'll discuss at the end of the process, okay? Look, I think what I found more interesting, and maybe we should give you a chance, is the issues you raised about that the process of protection is actually in the signing of the benefit sharing agreements is really where it is. So I'm going to let you bring me that part of the Act, and you said there were regulations that deal with this. Bring that to the committee so at least when we process this matter we can see what you're saying and evaluate your views on it. So please bring us that information of that part of the thing you've said. Obviously we're going to look at this thing further and so on. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
Well, just to reiterate the fact that these agreements don't straddle necessarily special areas governed by one authority. And so our concern is the level of potential conflict. I mean, what's trying to solve one problem and creating a whole lot of loose ends in the implementation through a different vehicle. I mean, there might be, traditional authority might have ownership of the land. It might look like a neat alternative for that body to receive the funding. But it doesn't take into account all the complexities, the spatial complexities. And we would submit that the situation as it currently stands is simpler to administer and should remain. And although it might not have been motivated by any malafide, nevertheless, this provision, suddenly the money goes to the authority and one doesn't know where it goes from there. And that doesn't seem fair if you're living inside or outside of one of these areas. So those are our two major concerns, which don't seem to be capable of being solved. And we submit that the situation as it currently is should rather remain. Thank you for the opportunity.
What worries me also is this is only going to apply where the traditional council is the stakeholder. I mean, where they aren't the stakeholder, the kind of confusion can be created by that, what Ms. Andrew is saying. I mean, if it's then an area where there's a dispute over the council, or an area where there's someone else that, in a traditional area, there's someone else that signs, that falls under this definition of is the stakeholder, then as you read this, it seems that when you're in a traditional area council, it always goes to that fund. The kind of confusion it can create is enormous. And I'm prepared to look at what you were saying, because there's maybe some merit in what you're saying, is that it's the signing of the buyer prospect agreement that becomes important, because there the minister must make sure the right stakeholder. Well, I'm prepared to look at all that stuff, but we'll have to see how clear that is. And as I said, the other issue to me is, these are the people that are your least problem. A stakeholder who is already a traditional counsel is your least of your problems. So we'll try to go and create a separate law for them and then potentially create further problems for us. It just seems nonsensical. Because they're the ones that are going to cost us money. It's the other ones that are going to cost us money that we can't define and so on. So let's have a look at that. We'll receive that information. And what you must do is, when we discuss this matter, make sure that Ms. Andrews gets this information so she can see what we're getting and what we're discussing, okay? And of course, you know our drill in this committee. Nothing stops you from making further submissions. We may not have further hearings, but you can always keep writing to us. I mean, if they give us stuff that you don't agree with at all, you can always talk and respond to it. Okay? Thank you very much, and thanks for making yourself available at short notice. Now the recalcitrant person who has no respect for Parliament and for this committee, may she please step forward and come to the front. She spent so much time in this committee, she's almost a member, and now it becomes, she's now disrespecting this committee. Can't make the times. And they tell us that business is efficient, eh? They tell us business is efficient. I'm going to listen to your excuse. You don't have an overhead. So please then sit here, Doctor. And the lady over there, please join up, because I want to see who the troublemakers are. I want to see who your faces are. See. What you can do for us, could you do me a little memo, a one or two page memo, on setting out this other process you're busy with? Where is it and what steps do you want to take, and a time frame? So when the committee discusses this, we have that in front of us and we can see how that's going to unfold. And then the second issue you have to look for me and give us some your legal advice. Where's the state law advisor and the parliamentary advisor. Will you please look at this process of the traditional leaders? As I understand the law and the regulations of Parliament, the rules of Parliament, is that when we deal with a matter of traditional leadership in legislation, they must have actually commented on the issue beforehand. Otherwise, procedurally, you've done the procedure incorrectly in Parliament. Did we look at that issue, the state law advisors and parliamentary advisors, when they did the, tagging? What is the situation? So can we just, and from your side also, will you give us an opinion on that? And then they will as well, together, give us one, how we've dealt with that issue. Okay, so let's look at that legality, because if we have a problem with it, then clearly we have to stop this process. Otherwise, you must get rid of this amendment. You know, you have to give up on the amendment, either one or the two. But even then, we'll have to strictly legally look at have we followed the right procedure, okay? So just do that for us, and let us have it as soon as possible. Okay, let us hear. Good morning. Should I say good evening? More likely, good evening, nice that you were able to. Sorry that we started so early for you. Okay, give us the reason. Tell us what the problems were.
expect, we are focusing on the amendments to NEMA. And here, while we accept that there's a lot of concern around alleged abuses of various provisions in NEMA, there are also a number of concerns about the efficiency and effectiveness of the implementation of particularly Section 24. So we really are quite concerned that we see frequent, increasingly stringent provisions coming into this Act, and yet we are not dealing with the challenges of implementation that we experience as business. We also note the additional instruments that are introduced here, and these instruments are...
I was just looking for your... Okay, I've got it, because I haven't got a screen.
I'm being
discriminated against, so I have to read actually what you're saying. Sorry, go ahead.
And what we also are concerned about, and we'll explain that in more detail, that we're introducing additional instruments to address environmental impact authorizations, and the instruments that were introduced in the amendment in 2009 are still to a large extent not implemented. We also ourselves, you know, we understand the controversy of 24G and how it's seen by other stakeholders compared to business, but we also believe that and have repeatedly asked for 24G to be amended to deal not only directly with EIAs but also the other, to remedy other mistakes that we may make in other licensing regimes under which are in the specific environmental legislation. Also, Chair, we are hoping that since our engagement last time on the National Waste Management Strategy, that you may see the way clear just to make the one small amendment to the waste definition, which was non-controversial. I wouldn't expect you to look at the more controversial aspect, but the waste definition, the part of it that was not controversial, we hope that you'd be able to look at. That waste definition, if you'll...
Just let me have a copy of that submission of yours, okay? Where you made the proposals, yeah, the previous one. Just that we can follow again. I just can't remember what it was. I remember there were wordings that were wrong and that we agreed were wrong and things like that. So just let me have a copy of that submission again so we can circulate it to members just to see what we're talking about. Again.
Thank you, Chief. That is, just to recall what it was the last part of the definition where the word and is used in the Act where it should be all. But we will certainly send that to you again.
And then, I mean, the cement people then also asked for other amendments. So there were a whole lot. So just give us those.
Can we give you everything?
Yeah, give me all those. We'll probably look at the more uncontroversial, but at least we'll have all of them in one.
We'll do that, Chair, no problem. Then, Chair, the insertion of Section 24 sub 2A, we understand that the provision, the insertion, is to allow the Minister to manage and conserve areas of the environment where currently she doesn't have power to do. We think that Section 24 contains a wide range of instruments that should allow her to do this. So to make this provision that as a result of saying that she doesn't have sufficient power, we're not entirely sure. We also accept that the use of exemptions is well established and is implemented. If the Minister is unhappy with something that we apply for exemption for, she just says no, or the MEC. So we thought that the need for this provision could be reviewed. Then 2AB, however, Chair, we know that once a bill has got as far as Parliament, it's not so easy to completely reverse the thought process. So we appreciate then, if the provision remains, that it's clear that this provision would not affect existing authorisation. So in other words, if a specific requirement is placed on a geographic area and there is already an authorised activity in that area, it would not be altered. However, what we believe is still a lack of clarity is whether this transitional provision, if I could call it that, also applies to authorizations in terms of specific environmental management acts like air quality, like waste,
or, and in addition, those authorizations given by the Minister of Mineral Resources.
So we think that one needs to give a clarity that the reference is not only to Section 24 authorization. Then, Chair, we appreciate that should the Minister decide that she wants to make specific prohibitions and restrictions in specific geographic areas, that she will ask for comment. What we believe is that, as in the case of the other specific Environmental Management Acts, where there's a notice that has a specific impact on a specific group of stakeholders, in this case, specific landowners, we believe that they should be specifically asked for their views. Then, Chair, the amendment of Section 24.10.1. Now, Chair, at the time that Section 24.10 was introduced, we saw it as a really useful amendment at the time, because it would allow us to look at current listed activities which are repetitive. For example, if you store hazardous chemicals in a volume above 500 cubic meters, you currently have to undertake an EIA, which we're doing. Now, if that is an activity which, if you manage it in a particular way, would have a negligible environmental impact. So this provision of using norms and standards, which if you applied them to a particular activity, you didn't need to go through the impact assessment. We thought it was a really useful intervention. However, we are not aware of a single standard that since 2009 that has either been developed or adopted in terms of this section. We have made application in respect of certain activities, and it still hasn't been implemented. So we're a bit worried. We're worried in two ways. We're a bit worried that we would now extend the scope of that provision when clearly we're having difficulty implementing what we've got. The listed activities that are gazetted have been identified carefully over a period of time. I think they're now in their fourth revision. The identification is done on the basis of the risk of adverse environmental impact, so that there's a careful consideration in doing the list. So we're not at all sure how the Act provides for us to control non-listed activities, because if the activity is not listed, you don't know what it is. How would you then control it through the mandatory application of a norm and standard? We're not quite sure how it would work. So we think that needs to have been reviewed. We think the motivation, the memorandum attached to the bill, in our view, does not adequately explain why this provision is required. And we think it would be important for the committee to request a progress report on current implementation, and also to understand how the non-listed activities in fact would be dealt with. Then, Chair, just before I pass off there, also in the Act itself, it refers to developed or adopted, which has been removed, is not included here. Then the amendments of 24C, we appreciate this introduction, because clearly the intention is to deal with those cases where the time frames in the regulations are not adhered to and there's long delays in the giving of a decision. However, we think that the priority must absolutely be for the relevant competent authority to have an efficient and effective decision-making process, and that's only in absolutely a last resort to go to the Minister. We would not like to see that this introduction of this in fact increases our cost,
increases our delay. Because the instant that you go from one competent authority to another, there is no question that you're going to have a delay. So while we accept and appreciate what is clearly the intention here, we think it needs to be looked at quite carefully. And also, it's no use giving the competent authority, other than the minister, a time frame within which a decision must be made, then say, well, look, if you don't come right there, you must go to the minister, and there's no time frame for the minister. So you could actually be in a worse situation when clearly the intention was that we would be in a better situation. Then, 24F, this is also the question of the compliance with norms and standards. We're confused by this check, to be honest. It never occurred to us that the compliance with norms and standards that were introduced to replace as an alternative for an authorization process, that they would not be mandatory. It was always our expectation that we had to comply with them. The instant that we didn't comply with them, we had to go through the authorization process. That was our understanding. So we're a little concerned with this, but the other big problem for us is the deletion or the failure to include in this amendment the term adopt. There are many national standards which already exist, which are useful for this purpose, and we would like that provision of adopt to remain, because otherwise it implies that this only refers to standards which would be developed by the department, and that is for us to remain. So we just wanted to comply with the existing act, and we think the reasons for the provision in respect of mandatory needs to be clarified. Now, 24G. Chair, I know that everybody thinks that every private sector active entity is looking for the best way to evade this legislation. It is not the case. Of course, there are people that don't comply with either the spirit or the letter. But we really believe that the 24G is, and this is what we argued for previously, I must say, when the 24G was introduced, that it needs to be used to remedy failures on the part of the applicant or the developer, project proponent, in respect of specific environmental legislation, not only NEMA. So we think that needs to be done. Also applies to mining legislation. We think it would be good to prescribe time periods. In the same way as we have time periods for decisions in other areas, we should have a time period here. We don't think that the applicant should be prosecuted once they have submitted the application, while there's in a sense a process pending. We think it needs to be clear that they shouldn't be prosecuted under those.
You're not going to get support for that from me.
It's my task to present my mandate, but I understand the problem.
That thing that it's one to one process there, the other must be followed, completely wrong. An offence is an offence.
No, definitely.
Once you've committed an offence, you should be charged.
So so in other words, if you
find the hell out of you, and you could first prosecute it.
I mustn't be able to come to you and say, I'm sorry, I heard.
You say you're sorry you heard, but then we let you pay for it, and we give you a criminal offence that you don't do it, and I'll be looking at this legislation. One strike and you're out.
One strike and you're out. Once you've made
a mistake, you will never get authorization again.
That's a very serious disincentive, Chair.
Very serious disincentive.
Especially if it was
I like
it. Wasn't deliberate.
Well,
I was negligent.
Well, we can look at that. I mean, we can look at the degrees of... but it's very difficult for me to see how a miner starts building roads and stuff without the authorization and was negligent.
No,
why he does it is I couldn't care less about the fine I'm going to get. I know I'm not going to get prosecuted because Dr. Lotta doesn't want me to be prosecuted, so I'm not going to be prosecuted. And I get away with a slap on my wrist. That must stop.
No, we absolutely cannot, as a collective business organisation, come to you and say that type of behaviour can be condoned. We absolutely can't, and that's really.
I'm looking at a clause in this bill to say every person that transgresses this clause must. get a bigamy.
Yeah, which of course is not exactly what's happening.
That's where I am now. I'm so upset with you guys for transgressing this.
Yeah.
Just doing it and then think you can get away with a slap on your wrist. And I want big fines. These small little fines of 9 million. That's peanuts for you guys. You make that in a day.
I wish that was true.
Their personal salaries is 9 million a day. Now you give them a fine of
money. I wish that was true, Chief.
You're not going to get from me, no sympathy here, Doctor. I think you should move on to another point.
I think
point.
So too, Chief.
You may have more success on another point.
I'm going to try. 24M, we believe that there's always cases for an exemption to be justified. We don't believe that exemption. We understand that there's concern that exemptions are abused, but an exemption can only be abused if an application is approved. I mean, the provision is there for the application to be rejected. And if applications are being leniently approved, of course it encourages additional applications. There's no question. But if the stringency of the applications are reviewed rigorously, which we have no difficulty with, we think that's totally appropriate, we don't think there's a reason to remove these exemptions. So we think that there's often cases where it is justified, particularly in cases where there's an activity which is a part of a bigger development. There are
why would we want to completely exempt? If you don't comply with for an authorization, surely you should at least come and apply for an apology and ask for us to forgive you. Because an exemption allows you to get away from completely. You can apply for an exemption, then you get away from completely. You don't have to come and apply to rectify the problem.
No, but Chair, the Act does not allow us to comply with completely.
You're saying you want to, you clearly want the fact that you should be able to apply for an exemption.
We want it because there are cases where we believe, we know that we can't get exemption from doing an from applying for an authorization on the listed activities. But there are cases in the listed activities where there's matters where there's a lack of clarity,
all it says, is no exemption may be granted from the requirement to obtain an authorization. That's right, isn't it?
You
should never be able to apply for an exemption not to apply for an authorization.
Oh, I see how you're reading.
So they're not looking at the other aspects of authorization. As an exemption still applies there, they're looking specifically that you should never. We're not going to give the minister, this is what this says actually, not for you. It says, we're not going to give the minister the power.
Yeah.
Well, let me say, the minister is her actor. She doesn't want the power to be able to look at a possible exemption for you where you haven't asked for authorization. And that, I think, is right. We shouldn't ever give a minister power to do that.
We're going to review how we read that.
Because I don't think it's the rest of the stuff. It just says the requirement to obtain authorization. So you're not allowed to exempt the fact where you've not applied for authorization. You should never be able to say, oh, well, this company was just, they were negligent. So we're not even going to let you go through the process where we want you to go through 24F. G. We're not going to even let you go through that process. We just want to exempt you. The minister said, I don't want that power.
No, that's it.
She says, I don't want that power. Because I don't want people now to come, instead of applying for me to forgive them, they want me not to just excuse them completely without going through the process. But in any case,
Then 24O, we find it very difficult. The authorization process is already very complex, very demanding, both on the regulator and on the applicant. We don't want to have a situation, and frankly speaking, Chair, we have the situation in water, not in the money, but in water affairs, where they do not gazette the requirements that they're going to apply to when they review a license application. They don't gazette it. It's an internal document. Of course we're supposed to comply with it, but if we don't know about it at the time that we apply, We prepare the application without knowing. We submit the application, then they come and they say, no, but you didn't deal with this and this. We are reading this amendment as putting us in the same position, and it's a bad position. Chair, honestly it is. We're saying you want to change the way you look at things, the way you, the kind of requirements that you have, 100%. That's the prerogative of the regulator, but you need to tell us about it before the time. We can't have a situation where we apply.
But doesn't this clause actually make it better for you?
We don't think so.
Because previously it only said that had been developed. It now says that has been adopted.
But we don't know.
No, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's much. It's a adopted is better than developed. Previously, there may be a document that Ms. Garland has been sitting there under a desk, but now there has to be a process of adoption. Whatever that document may be, it'll have to be officially adopted. So not just any document can apply. Previously, any document that has been developed could apply.
But Chief,
now only the adopted ones can apply.
Chief, if you are reading adopted as it went through a process like there was a public consultation process, it was gazetted or whatever, then we 100%
well, it may be that because, you know, it'll depend on the instrument. If it's a regulation, it may go through that process. If it's another issue, it may not go through. There may be another process. But, I mean, now it's making the clause stronger because it's saying you're only bound by those documents that have been adopted. The department can't just pull out some discussion document they've had there for years and so on, some other document lying around. There had to be a process. Now, it's difficult here to tell you what process it is because it will depend on the instrument. Some instruments have to be adopted in a certain way.
See, I understand that, but we would be comfortable with it if we understood what adopted meant. If we understood the way you are implying it should be, I think we would be much more comfortable. But it's exactly the process that you've described is exactly what we experience with AutoFair. We can submit an application on a form today. A year later, we still haven't got the license. We ask, where's the license? They come back and say, no.
Does this act apply to water?
No, but this is why we fear it. Why we've got a difficulty with the provision because of the experience with water, which we've never had with environmental affairs, to be honest. This looks to us. I can see that it's your point of
view. But okay, go along. So this is more onerous on the department.
So but I see
not how more onerous on you, because you will definitely now be able to raise as a defence that have you show us where you adopted this document. If you haven't adopted it, it won't bind you. Whereas previously you would never be able to use that as a defence. It will be any document that has been developed, whatever that may mean. I don't even know what it means.
But adopt you see as stronger. Okay.
It doesn't exclude your problem that if you don't know what's adopted. But in terms of you, in your response then, you are now in a stronger position to say, you say I'm a supplier, this and this. Can you please show me where you adopted this document?
But Chief, we want to be in that position.
Yes, because you're in a stronger position. I mean, you're now completely at the mercy of the department.
But I think that for us, one of the biggest problems is the delay that this kind of uncertainty causes. So we would be very pleased to see some kind of definition of adopt, and then we could...
No, well, adopt is adopt. It says the legal instrument adopted. It will depend on what legal instrument it is. If they tell you have not complied with the regulations...
No.
You will know that the regulations have to be adopted in this way.
Yes.
So you will know how to act. If they say you did not comply with our guideline document X, then you would be able to say, okay, but can you please tell me where you adopted and what is your procedure of adoption? You will then have entitled to ask that, I mean, as the person that is being asked to do this. So what I'm saying to you, in this thing, all I see this clause as, is it tightens up the requirement of what the department may rely on. I mean,
I can see that you could read it like that. We'll think about that.
I don't know, it doesn't take away other problems that you
no.
don't necessarily know the document,
correct.
But it does
correct.
Deal, it does make a stronger requirement that the department must comply with. Okay, next one.
Then, to the amendment of Section 28. Now, we understand that the application of Section 28 could be challenging. This is the duty of care. Currently, Susan, that we've got a number of challenges with this. Currently, an organ of state must consult. They can't just issue a directive without consulting either, depending if it's a mining situation, they have to consult with the Minister of Mineral Resources. If it's a water issue, they have to consult with the Minister of Water Affairs. We've got now the same minister, but at the time it was a different. So, we're not sure why we would now introduce the... We think that's 100% in respect of cooperative government. The fact that it could take a bit longer, we still think is worthwhile. But to remove that requirement to consult, we're not sure at all why it was done. And we think that there should at least be provision to consult with the Director General as appropriate, if it's mining, for example, or water, or the provincial head of department as appropriate. But we think to completely remove the requirement to consult is a
consulting with another organization.
Yes, yes.
But it says very clearly, may, after having given adequate opportunity to affected persons, so if an organ of state is an affected person, they must be given proper notification, they must be informed of their interest.
Oh, and then they don't respond, they can be ignored.
But all this does is puts it in line with your Administrative Justice Act.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Your admin justice. I mean, you don't have to, in this legislation, put all these things about consulting. Your Administrative Justice Act puts all the requirements of a proper administrative justice decision. So that act will apply to every decision here. So if you don't comply with the Admin Justice Act, then you will be knocked out. I mean, all that they've taken here is that you must consult with other organs of state, which is, I don't know why they put it in the first place.
Yeah.
It's the funniest clause I've ever read, is why do you put in an act that an organ of state is... If they said that you must consult with civil society, I can at least, I wouldn't think why you put it, if I at least see you, you know, why. But why have acts said you must consult with an organ of state? I think the more important clause is the latter part, after having given adequate opportunity. Now, that is what your admin justice says. If before you make a decision, you must give the affected person audi arte.
Yeah.
And that's what this clause says. And you've got... In fact, this clause is not even needed here. If you didn't have it there, you would in any case have your admin justice who would do the same thing. This is just an extra, what do you call it, buckles and braces, keeping your pants up. If you've got a big pants like mine, it's important. You have a lot of buckles and braces to keep it up, else it falls down.
Then, the next part of Section 28 is much bigger. In Section 28 currently, the reference is to the requirement to take, in the duty of care, the requirement to take reasonable measures, significant pollution, to avoid the significant pollution. In other words, both the pollution and the measures are qualified. It's not just any pollution, it's not just any measure. The way the amendment is drafted is it removes the reasonable and it removes the significant. That is a problem. And we also can't in the explanatory memorandum, we just read that as a challenge for EMI. We're not at all sure what that challenge actually is, what the problem is that we're trying to fix here.
Sorry, I'm not spoiling.
Yeah.
Where does it take reasonable out? Which part of the course?
In section...
I can see significant, but I can't see where we are moving reasonable.
Okay, because you say that I'm going to get it. It says that we've got to take measures. It doesn't say we must take reasonable measures. Chair, my colleague will look for it for me. The other problem, Chair, is that the existing provision allows the regulator to say to us, this activity of yours is so out of control, you must cease it. They have that power to give us that directive,
yeah.
And we understand it. But it's a it's a big step to take to stop an activity. So the way the current provision is worded is that it's seen clearly as a last resort. So they give you a directive, you ignore them. You can't, you know, to improve your performance or whatever. You've got to have a draconian provision in that case. But you can't, which is what the provision now is saying, tell us to cease at the same time. It's and. It's one of those and or. Here it should be. The and is also wrong in our view. You can't cease an activity and take measures because the activity is stopped. You can't then. There's no possibility for you to ameliorate how you carry out that activity. So we think that if we understood exactly what the problem was, we could make a better comment. But from the memorandum, we can't understand it.
Isn't the possibility that some of these situations are and or? I mean, some instances, it may be that they say cease, there's nothing else that needs to be done, that's the end of the story.
We can never stop.
But there are other cases where you say cease, but because you've been busy with pollution, you may still have to want to, I mean, they still may want to say, well, please go and investigate this for us, please stop, you know, this stuff is flowing into a river now. So that, you know, isn't that exactly what it means?
But Chair, that is not what is written. We would accept that there's a case. If you are pumping an untreated effluent into a river, you have got to cease that activity. There's no question about it. But the understanding of that cessation is that you will then, it's a temporary thing, there are conditions under which you may reinstate the activity. This provision is not drafted like that. It's drafted as to solve a problem that we don't understand. I think that's really the big thing, because it just says in the memorandum that it's to address challenges experienced by EMI.
But you see, I don't look at the memorandum. I look at the wording in the Act. I don't even read that memorandum. I know how they draft these things. It's the last thing they do at the end. They're not carefully worded. I'm not saying in this instance it isn't, but I know these memorandums. I mean, I've been through this process 100 times. The memorandum is something that someone, in fact, they usually let the juniors draft. Edward the Garb has got so important things to do. She hasn't got time.
I shouldn't do it.
She doesn't draft the memorandum. She asks the clerk, grade 5, to say, just quickly draft those things for us. So I think, don't look at the memorandum. The memorandum has no legal effect whatsoever. Look at the Act and tell me the Act what's wrong. You see, because all the Act says to me, if I read it here, it says, you're causing, as cause or may cause, significant pollution to grade data. 2, cease activities. 2, investigate, evaluate. 2, commence taking specific measures. That's where there's the problem. 2, diligently continue with those measures and complete those measures before a specified reasonable date, provided that the Director General. I mean, if you read the Act, it makes perfect sense. The and, you may question the word and. I would have been more cautious if I were the drafters by putting and there, because someone may interpret you can only do it if you do all those.
Yes, that's
is that what and means?
Yes.
And you may want to word it, where you just want to seize, you may want to just say seize or seize and then the rest of the stuff we want to have it as an and. But that is, we'll look at that,
yes,
that technicality. But as I say, rather look at the Act than the meeting.
But do we know what the problem is that we're trying to solve here?
Well, the problem is, as I can see it, is this is a clause that allows you, the DG, to give directives.
Which is cool.
And the directive is cease or, so it's just cease, or cease and investigate, cease and commence taking specific measures, cease and continue diligently to apply those measures, cease and complete those measures before a specified reasonable date. That is where you're busy with pollution. It tells you those are the I would have been more careful. I would have put a catch-all phrase here, for example. I would have been much more careful with this. This is very, very tightly drafted. Now that the legislation is the committee's legislation, we may make it much better. But I think that's all it does. It tells you the different things they can do, the DG can do.
But I think we've really got two concerns. The one is that you can't necessarily, in practice, do all of them. A directive that...
It will depend on each action.
Correct. So
in one pollution, you may just seize. Another pollution, you may seize and pick up what you've done and stop this from running into the river. Another one may be seize and clean the pit in which you put the stuff out and put sand in it. So, that's what it can be. It can be seized plus other things.
Our difficulty is that it doesn't, that wide range of possibilities that you have set out there, which we agree absolutely with, we don't believe that the text as written gives you that.
It may, as I said, we'll look at it. We'll make it tighter.
And
add the catch-all phrase.
And then, Chair, that we want to see that when we're talking about pollution, we're talking about significant, which is what the Act says, and when we talk about measures, we talk about reasonable measures.
Well, I mean, you see, that is exactly what administrative law is all about. If you were not to take a reasonable measure, administrative law would knock you flat on your back, and you will have all the remedies in that Act, not here. All your remedies is in admin law, not in your environmental law.
Do you know what our difficulty is? We do not want to take the government on review because they took a decision.
No, you should. If the government didn't comply with the Administrative Justice Act, you must take them on review. The problem is you guys do it spuriously as well, and just because you've got a lot of money, you don't mind going to courts. But where there's a genuine instance where, I must tell you, I drafted the Administrative Justice Act, so I know. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the Administrative Justice Act is there to create better governance.
Yeah.
Before government makes decisions, it must comply with certain things. If it's this kind of decision you're taking, this is what you comply with. Once you've taken the decision, you must give reasons for your decision. So that act is central to governance. Everything we do in all the other departments is governed by two acts. Well, not just two, but definitely by two. Your Administrative Justice Act, which tells you how you take administrative decisions, and your Promotion of Access to Information Act. Those are your two cornerstone legislation, how government should act for good governance. Those two pieces of legislation apply to everything we do. So anything that we do incorrectly in terms of those two pieces, you should be able to take us to court and get it rectified. So you mustn't have any fears of that. The problem is, I very strongly urge departments not to go and recreate administrative justice clauses and other pieces of legislation. Because then you've got a problem. Not I've got a problem, but you've got a problem. Because now you've got two pieces of legislation. And they may be contradictory, because the one will deal with one little aspect, whereas the one creates a holistic system of decision making. So it's very much important that we don't create extra requirements and so on in other legislation. That the real ones that we must understand are those that comply. Sometimes there may be reasons. I mean, one of the problems I do have is that a lot of their environmental laws do create responsibilities that are already covered under admin justice and under now when you get to court you have a problem, because every single time it's the problem of the eventual government for this department, because it has created clauses that may be in conflict with that other legislation. It creates its own problems then, because the court will justifiably say, you knew when you drafted this legislation the Promotion of Access of Justice existed. Why did you put this clause in here? You must have meant something. So it means you've created some extra. You couldn't have created the same. So it must be something extra that you've created. And that is why one needs to be very careful, I say, in this legislation, in other departments, when you have the central law that guide you on these issues.
Thank you.
That's why, I mean, I don't, when it comes to administrative justice, I try and take as much as I can out of this legislation.
And I think, Chief, because you know that administrative justice so well, that's
absolutely.
Your lead.
No, absolutely.
Which we perhaps don't look at clearly.
And also, as I say, the department is the one that creates the problem. Because by introducing other clauses like that, you have to give meaning. We as legislators, you know, there's something the courts call what was the intention of the legislator.
Yeah.
Now, if there are clauses that cover something that's already been covered, the court must say, but, well, either you're creating something additional or you're amending what exists.
Correct.
It's the only way. You can't do any other. You couldn't have had any other intention. No one is stupid enough, the court will say, not even a legislator, is stupid enough to repeat the same thing twice in legislation. They couldn't have been so stupid. Well, they'll be surprised, of course.
But,
okay, go to the next one.
Okay, then, Chair, we've dealt with this. Let me just see.
Just remember that clause, Ms. Garlop, we need to relook, eh? I think it's loosely worded, all right?
Then, Chair, we understand why, this is the amendment of Section 44 which deals with regulations. We understand that there are cases in terms of multilateral environmental agreements, particularly those dealing with chemicals, where import and export control is required. What we don't understand is this broad power that is now introduced here. Because we don't understand the problem. It's again a question of we don't understand the problem.
Which clause is this?
The clause in the amendment of 44.
44, okay.
Where there's a new provision for a power to make a regulation. So it's adding the possibility to make regulations dealing with the prohibition, control, sale, distribution, import or export of products that may have a substantial detrimental effect on the environment or on human health. Now the problem with that is very broadly worded. Let's take for example the case of chemicals used in the manufacture of narcotics, which would be covered by this provision. We don't expect the Department of Environmental Affairs to deal with that. But we want it because
and
human health.
We've already told them they must change human health.
Okay.
It must be human health as insofar as it is affecting the environment. You have to narrow the human health.
As the environment will say.
No, we said you can't make regulations for the Department of Health.
So
if there are health issues arising out of environmental problems like pollution, then they can do that,
correct.
But then they must also, of course, consult the Department of Health, which in the next amendment they don't do. So we have picked that up, the health issue already. So your point is a valid one.
But it also goes to the regulation. If you have a regulation prohibiting the import of a chemical, you have to go to the International Trade Administration Commission to actually implement that, which is not under the control of the Minister of Trade and Industry anymore. That body is under the control of the Minister of Economic Development. Economic Development. We're worried about what we're trying to do here, if not...
They're giving the Minister a power to do those things which apparently exist in another piece of legislation. Was taken out and never replaced. That is what they're trying to do, if I understand. Which act was it that was taken out of?
It was in terms of the Environment Conservation Act. And we already got regulations, the plastic bag regulation, asbestos regulation.
What I think is we'll have to look at this as now that Dr. Lott has raised this, I want us to, you must flag this because I must, we only made comment about whether the health issue should be there or how narrowly it should be stated. But I think we need to re-look this because it looks to me that it is such a substantive power given to the minister But I don't think it's something you can't you can regulate in regulations without giving the power in the act itself.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, it just doesn't seem to me right that you give a power to substantially affect people's rights and the way we trade and so on. And it's actually something that's done through regulations, and the power is not in the act itself. Okay, so just flag that for me. All right, go ahead.
Then, Chair, really, in conclusion, we recognize that laws must be continuously updated and improved, but we think that it's important to consider whether the amendment is well motivated, doesn't increase the regulatory burden without taking into account improving also getting a better environmental outcome in this case. We concerned, Chair, that our understanding is that all bills, that Cabinet decided that all bills must go through a regulatory impact assessment. That is our understanding. But this is not the only bill that we're working on currently, Chair, where that doesn't appear to be the case. So we just wondered how does that work, and because we think that's a good process. And we think that it would also help portfolio committees if such a report accompanied the bill to Parliament. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, you have to be a rich democracy to do that. No, if you have to put every piece of legislation, we pass hundreds of pieces of legislation, thousands of regulations. The ideal situation is to put them through processes where they're looked at. But the problem is, in reality, they're like one or two countries in the world that can do it.
Yeah, can do it from everything.
Because they have capacity and they have the finances to do so. So I think if I can recall when I was there in another life of mine, we are aspiring to that as a country, but it's going to take a long time for us to get there. Where these, you know, one can go and look at the financial implications and you look at the regulatory implications and so on. But we far off of that. It's a wish though. It's a wish that's gone quite far. The previous administration, I don't know now because I haven't been around, how far they've taken it. But there, we were going quite far to try and create that capacity in the presidency.
Yeah.
But it's like creating another department. But you have to get people who have the financial, the different capacities in all these areas to be able to look at a piece of legislation and say, okay, this will be the implications. Those are highly skilled people. Highly, highly skilled. So I think we're not there yet. It's a wish list. Okay, is that it?
That's
it. Those are all the issues. Members, any questions? A whole lot of important issues being raised those other amendments that are not in the bill, we'll look at that separately. Then section 24, 1A, the previous inputs didn't comment on this, but there are some comments there that need to be looked at. 24C, there weren't previous comments, there's some comments there. F and G, where there were comments, these are additional comments. M, that's the exemption one, which probably is right. O, 28 and 44 have been comments. All right, any questions? All clear? Have I exhausted Dr. Lotta and a whole lot of you? All right. Obviously, we're going to sit down and look at these further. I must be brutally honest, not having been involved in environment and not being part of drafting this legislation, it's not easy to kind of understand it and how it impacts and so on. What I am going to do in any case is as a committee, been trying now for a long time, and every time it's a committee that changes our agenda. But we have asked the department to come and deal with us with all the challenges they find exist around EIAs. And that process, I think, is now set down for September or October. So it's something we're looking at on an ongoing basis. Clearly, we want to protect our environment. On the other hand, we must try and make sure that a balance is created. Okay, everyone happy? Everyone has questions? From the department side, I don't usually do this, but seeing as there's extra time and people have flown all the way here, even if they were late, is there anything on your side you would want to comment on now in the last submissions that was made? Give some clarity on it. So a whole lot of things they ask, they can't understand why this is here, why that is there.
Chairperson, we are in the process of preparing comprehensive responses on all the comments, and some of it we need to consult, but I just want to say in relation to the environmental instruments, we make use of environmental management frameworks and those are implemented. We are busy with a number of norms and standards which are in the process, and the reason why we did not limit it to listed activities, we wanted to open it up that we could have norms and standards for geographical areas or for a specific sector, rather than to limit it that there should be a listed activity. Of course, the Act makes provision that we can have norms and standards for listed activities, and then it's a separate list from your normal EIA list. We can have that too, but we wanted not to limit it to those lists so that we can broaden it.
You want to create good practices, and the way you create it is by creating norms and standards in all areas of the environment.
Examples are, we are busy with, for example, routes for 4x4s in sensitive areas. Those are the norms and standards that we currently are looking at.
4x4?
For 4x4 in sensitive.
Oh, you must talk to St. Lucia. Those people send me emails every single day about 4x4s on the beaches. Really, I'm sick and tired of these. Get those regulations done so it stops the issue. Well, they won't stop sending the emails, of course, they're still sending, because they don't want them for being off the beaches.
That is what I wanted to add, but on the enforcement, there were a number of issues raised, and I don't know whether Ms. Craigie wants to add
any. Any of you want to add something just as a small response at this stage, seeing as we've got extra time? As I say, I don't usually allow it, but...
Chair, I think maybe you did address some of the issues. I think one of the biggest reasons for taking reasonable out of Section 28 was because it is covered by PAJA already, and that we are bound by reasonableness, as you said. So I'm not sure that I really need to respond on the other issues.
But anything you do administratively, there are two criteria. One is reasonableness, but the overall one is rationality. So anything that you do is unreasonable, doesn't fall under rationality, the courts will be able to put it out. So those are the protections you have. Okay. Thank you very much. If you have any further issues to raise or comments to make, you're always free to send it to us. We do circulate it to members that allow them access to it. And then, as you're saying, Dr. Golub, you guys are, every single amendment that is being suggested, even if we respond from up here, you do write it down for us so that we can process it later, eh? You keep doing that, eh? Okay. All right, so we finished for today. It's been a very useful morning, I felt. I think some of the important issues have been raised. As I said, I think there are some difficulties where Dr. Lotta has not heard this, but one of the problems is that there's a separate process taking place in the department where they are actually reviewing even some of these laws. Some of these are stopgap amendments. A whole big review is taking place in the department on some of these issues, which makes it very difficult for the committee to process, because, you know, we hear problems and then to say, well, this problem may be dealt with later, and then we must make amendments. It's very, I find it a very difficult process, but be that as it may, we must try and see how we can fit it in. I've also suggested you let us have certain things already. Please jot those down also as tasks. I mean, those opinions we need and the further information we need, make sure we get all that stuff. Tomorrow we continue. We had to juggle the program because we had to bring one forward. Maybe what you could do for us, Dr. Lotta, the Chamber of Mines was going to come today and then they pulled out. I can't believe that, as devastating as Lonmin is, that the Chamber of Mines have only two people working for them and they pull out of drafting submissions and so on that affect them. If you can just check with them if they still want to come. We'll try and make chances for them, but... Well, there, you can tell them there the two departments are sitting down and talking, and as we were briefed as a committee 3-4 weeks ago by them, that they are very positive about the process of the integrated licensing that's taking place. So I don't know. That's something also we'll get a report back soon, but that is proceeding well. Whatever well may mean. In fact, we were told they were finalizing things in August. Is it still like that? Does it still look like that? The agreements you guys were making? Still, August is still your deadline. What's the date today? 21st. You've got 9 days. To finalize. Okay, so that process you can say is looks like it's moving. Of course, it did help that we had a constitutional court judgment in our favor. Well, when I say in our favor, I'm now talking anti-mine, of course, but that has shaken you guys a bit and has shaken that department a bit, and that they realize they have to move because the courts are starting to intervene. So hopefully those processes will show some results by this month. They will take us forward. Okay, anyone else want to raise anything? Okay, so tomorrow we are listening to... our old friends. They're almost older than this Dr. Lotta in terms of participation here. The Cementius Society, the Cementius Producers. You remember, what is his name?
Doctor?
Right. He's here again. The Paper Manufacturers Association and Rand Water. Those are the three for tomorrow, okay? And we are still trying to get the minister to... You remember, she wanted a slot for the political input. We're still trying to sort that out. If we can fit it in tomorrow, we'll try, but wherever. So please go back to DG and to Errol in the minister's office. Just tell them we're still waiting for that date, okay? Because we would want to make a special slot where we want to fit it in. They did say they're trying to get up for tomorrow, but I'm not sure, okay? All right. So we'll do that tomorrow here again at 9:30. Okay? Thank you, members. Thank you for all the inputs today. And thank you for the public for